I want to ask you, must be a thrill ride for you that so quickly this podcast has taken off like a rocket. Have you been enjoying it?
I have. I mean, it's hard to, I think one of the things that I feel lucky about is that I don't feel like I'm part of it in some ways. I still listen to it and feel like I'm listening to someone else, mostly because the focus for me is so much about the movie and the person talking about it and less about myself, mm-hmm. which I'm really grateful that I have that compartmentalism and that ability to not feel super involved in it. It's also just been a joy to be able to show people that movies can be just as important and sacred as, honestly, religion or any other thing that folks look to for meaning. So that's been, I feel like I'm a proselytizer. I'm like converting people, and that makes me feel really good.
Wow, what a great posture to have. Good for you.
No, oh, thank you. Yeah, I mean, I got an email from a guy who has been avoiding Star Wars all of his life. And the first episode we did was about Star Wars Episode 4. And he said that listening to the episode actually made him want to go watch it, which is something he's never wanted to do. And I thought, that is it. That is the win for me. If everybody goes and watches the movies that we talk about, I feel like we've won.
It was a great episode. I think I've listened to all of them, and I've really been enjoying it.
Oh, thank you. I really appreciate that. And your feedback about Mr. Rogers, we also got from other listeners, so thank you for that. I think
I see what you're getting at, but it was good.
I think it was more for myself, honestly, Seth, than for anyone else. I just was trying to center myself in Mr. Rogers' like love and care, and I realized that nobody else really needs to hear that. So I just got the thumbs up and we're ready to go. Are you good on your end?
Well, now, wait, let me just, you have a little bit of an echo, but my echo went away,
I do.
Which is good.
Okay.
Wait, did it just come back? One, two cannibals are eating a clown. One says the other, does this taste funny to you? No, my echo's gone. Okay. I think we're good now.
That's a great joke.
That's my sound check every time.
Really? I'm actually going to write that down because my dad is always looking for new repertoire and the man is exhausting all the jokes he has. So two cannibals eating. Okay, I'm not kidding. I'm writing this down because
this is
this is how I communicate with my father. We don't really engage in any other way, but I'll call him and tell him, hey, Dad, there's a joke. okay, so it sounds good to you on your end?
Yes, it sounds perfect.
Okay, so let's go ahead and start. So I am curious because, unlike a lot of people who I've spoken to about movies, I don't actually know the answer to this with you, which is, what role have movies played in your life?
I live and swim in the culture. Everything from, you know, which Batman episode was the best in 1966 to how do people talk about the changes to our atmosphere? Because culture defines us. And movies are a big piece of culture because what happens in movies is in just an hour or two or three, they hit us with a wallop and create images that can stick around forever. So for me, the experience of seeing the movie in real time isn't as powerful as it used to be, but the memes and the concepts that stick around, those things are in my life for a really long time.
That's interesting. So what has changed for you that you feel they're not as powerful as they used to be?
You know, I feel because I grew up with 1/10 the amount of media input we have now, that it was easier to sort of filter things out and embrace things. So when I was 12 or 13 and saw The Andromeda Strain 3 or 4 times, that movie really got under my skin.
Yeah.
Whereas now I feel like I have reflector shields up all the time and I need media to bounce off me more often because it's all become weaponized and designed to hurt us or impact us really hard. And if I open myself up too much to that, I'm fearful that it might take me out of the game for weeks or months.
Yeah, it's something that we don't often talk about, which is movies, specifically movies' ability to just kind of shake us and leave us shaken for days. I remember the first time that I saw Dr. Zhivago, I couldn't stop crying. It was days of crying. And my father was like, okay, you got to stop this a little bit. You're being a little melodramatic. But it felt so personal and the tragedy of that romance. And I don't have that reaction anymore to movies. And I think about how much of that is, it was the first time that I had seen something like that. And also just to your point, there wasn't that much out there for me to be bombarded with.
Yeah, it's the analogy might be what has happened to things like potato chips and junk food, which is we evolved to want to eat things that are fat or salt or sweet. And if a company decides to maximize on all of those elements, we probably eat too much of them. And what's happened is, you know, a movie used to cost $2 million to make, and now it costs $100 million to make. They're spending the other $98 million on figuring out which buttons that they can press in us over and over again. And sometimes that button pressing pays off, and other times it could just deaden us.
Yeah, that is so true. Well, I'd like to take you back in time travel together with you, by asking you to close your eyes and for 10 seconds think about the first time that you saw The Wizard of Oz. Think about how old you were, where you were, how it made you feel, and then I'll chime in when the 10 seconds are up. So what memories came up for you then?
Oh, quite a chill of memory and nostalgia there. So in 1966, my parents bought a color TV and it got stolen out of their car. And therefore, they said we weren't going to get another color TV. And it wasn't till months later that we got one. And I'm pretty sure it was February and we're sitting in the living room and it was the annual showing of The Wizard of Oz. And that movie, of course, begins in black and white and sepia tones and then transfers to color. And as somebody who didn't grow up with color TV, that was an extraordinary thing. But mostly my memory is that feeling of safety with mom and dad and my two little sisters sitting in our little house in Buffalo, New York, watching this miracle happen on TV in front of us. And I've probably seen it 10 times, 15 times since then, like everybody else. And one of the reasons that The Wizard of Oz is such an important movie is that we've all seen it.
And yeah,
so
yeah.
It becomes
it's a touchstone.
A touchstone, exactly.
Mm. Yeah. You know, I was reading, Roger Ebert is a film hero of mine, and I was reading his review of The Wizard of Oz, and he had so many beautifully perceptive things to say about it. And he framed it in a way that I never thought about. He says here that there are elements in The Wizard of Oz powerfully fill a void that exists inside many children. For kids of a certain age, home is everything, the center of the world. But over the rainbow, dimly guessed at, is the wide earth, fascinating and terrifying. And I just wondered, when you were a kid, you know, what did you first perceive about that movie?
For me, it's always been about the instigation. That, you know, Dorothy was perhaps the only genuine, independent young woman heroine in movies for decades and decades.
Yeah, you talked about how there's never been a teenage girl like her, right, in film in that way.
Yeah, I mean, treated without misogyny, without sexualization, here is this person who's a hero. And the thing about it is, except for her accidentally killing both witches, everything else that happens in the movie happens because Dorothy instigates. Mm. She says, let's go. Come on, let's go. He can help. We can go there. And that idea that a young person can take action is extraordinary. And the way it was juxtaposed with, you know, the vaudeville stuff, with the fantasy stuff, with the Munchkin stuff, made it feel safer because it wasn't somebody taking action in your school or your playground. It was someone taking action in this idealized world. But what I took away, the biggest thing I took away, is it's up to us and we could do it if we wanted to.
Yeah, that's so true. Yeah, you know, Ebert says in his review later on, I'm just thinking about this as you're talking, that they're touching on the key lesson of childhood, which is that someday the child will not be a child, that home will no longer exist, that adults will be no help because now the child's an adult and must face the challenges of life alone, but that you can ask friends to help you. And that even the Wizard of Oz is only human and has problems of his own.
Wow. Yeah, there's so much to dissect here. You know, the idea that the wizard was a con man, but a con man with a golden heart, is another great juxtaposition. That humbug was a term that people used to use a lot in the P.T. Barnum days. And it was the idea that somebody was not only a fraud, but gleeful about it. That when you went to see a P.T. Barnum show, you knew there wasn't really a mermaid in the other room. And you were paying, knowing that you were going to get fooled, and getting fooled was part of the deal.
Hmm. But it's interesting because when she finds out that she's been fooled by the wizard, I mean, she's not angry. I also, that struck me watching it again this week, was that she's very kind, and actually their interactions are very kind.
Yeah, you know, Kansas life in those days, never having lived there and never been there then, you know, oh, your dog misbehaved, we're going to kill him. Oh, the house got blown over by a tornado, well, we'll just have to recover.
Yeah,
and you know,
because life was hard. Yeah,
life was really hard, and I think that Dorothy's lack of bitterness throughout the entire movie, except when she's trying to protect Toto, again gets under our skin. Mm. Now, there are a couple bits of background because I'm a marketer who looks at culture that I think need to be mentioned because the creation myth here is essential.
Mm.
It's important to know that when the movie came out. It was trying to chase after Snow White, which was the most successful movie ever made at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And 14 different people worked on the screenplay. And
that was crazy. I was like, oh my God, how did this even get made?
Exactly. And 5 different people worked on directing it. The first director got pulled to go make Gone with the Wind. I mean, it was a complete accident that this movie even got made. And when it came out, except for the New York Times, almost every critic hated it. And so what we learn here is that you can create an act of genius without being a genius, and that the critics are usually wrong.
Yeah.
And that the cultural aspect of we saw it in this new space on TV where it was optimized to make an impact. Again, there could only have been one movie that pulled that off, and it happened to have been The Wizard of Oz. But what is so cool is that you can whistle a couple notes or bring up a line from it, and the other people you're talking to will instantly know what you're talking about. And that's what makes culture a culture.
Hmm. That's so true. You know, you gave a keynote speech at a marketing conference where you talked about The Wizard of Oz, and I love what you said. So if you don't mind, I'll read back what you said there. You said, Dorothy goes to the wizard and explains what she wants, and the wizard says, I will help you, but first bring me the broomstick of the Wicked Witch of the West. He didn't need a broomstick. He had plenty of broomsticks. He was sending Dorothy away so she wouldn't come back. And there are all these people in your lives, when you go to them for reassurance, when you go to them to be picked, who say, first bring me the broomstick, and they send you off, not because they need it, but because they don't want you to come back. And it's fascinating to me that you were able to see this in the movie. And it's clear to me that it's shaped your work. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about that, how it has shaped your work and how you see marketing in particular.
I began my career as a book packager, and what book packagers do is the same thing movie producers do. We make complicated books. We're not always the author, but we put together the team. And in 12 years, I did 120 books, but along the way, I got more than 1,000 rejections. Book publishers Wow. who would send me a note saying, we read your proposal, no. And sometimes they would say no, but sometimes they would say, but we want a broomstick first.
Oh.
And what I discovered, having wasted time for years and years chasing broomsticks, is that sometimes it makes sense to go get a broomstick, but usually it doesn't. That usually what someone who says no to you, but with a broomstick request, is saying is, I don't have the heart to tell you how I really feel, but how I really feel is this isn't for me. And we get so easily confused because we don't believe we deserve to be rejected. And we have trouble empathizing with people who say, this isn't for me. And if we can forgive the other person and forgive ourselves, when someone says, nah, I don't get it, we can say to them, oh, well, it's not for you. And so when I think about something as important and groundbreaking as this podcast you're building, you know, the fact is 99.9% of the people in America have never heard it. And even if it becomes the most successful podcast in history, 98% of the people in America will never hear it.
That's so true.
And that's fine because
yeah.
it's not for them. And if you try to make it something for them, you'll wreck it. So instead, the right thing to do is do what you need to do and find your people. And that is how, in fact, the Wizard of Oz found its grounding as well, is that each year, year after year, the people who got the joke wanted it again. And the people who didn't tune in. That's okay. Mm. It's not for you.
Yeah, that's so true. That's so true. You know, one of the things that really struck me watching the movie again this week was how funny it is. I don't think I caught on to that when I saw it as a little girl. There is a lot of humor, especially among, you know, the Tin Man and the Scarecrow and the Lion. And I love the scenes where Dorothy meets each one of them and kind of starts to become friends with them and their whole journey together. And I just wonder, you know, what are the characters or the scenes, even the lines that you always go back to, the moments in The Wizard of Oz that you always go back to?
Well, they made a really smart choice, and they hired vaudeville guys to play the three of them. And it was a common trope to introduce yourself in character on stage because you didn't have a lot of time. So none of the three of them were stretching that far to have that loose-limbed, approachable, charismatic thing going on. It didn't feel forced. I always found the lion to be a little bit annoying. And I've always been in love with Ray as the Scarecrow. And, it turns out that my niece, growing up when she was a little kid, had a Scarecrow, a doll, and she named him Ray. And that made me really happy. But the Margaret Hamilton as the witch is my favorite accessory character, I think. Mm. Now, I have to tell a semi-embarrassing story. I have a few Wizard of Oz things in my life. The first one is I live in a little town outside of New York, and across the street from the school is a giant park. And the park is called the Burke Estate because Billy Burke, who played Glinda, lived in my town. And this was her land. But the other overlap is in 1984, I worked for an educational computer game company called Spinnaker, and I did science fiction adventure games, but then we branched out, and I did the Wizard of Oz adventure game on Commodore 64 format with illustrations and music.
And I, cool.
I did something that I'm not proud of, though, which is we were halfway through making it, and there's a scene in the software and the movie where the witch goes, "Nya-ha-ha," and I didn't know how to spell that. And you can't Google it, but we needed to write it out. So I picked up the phone and I called the Salem Witch Museum. And I thought I would just ask the Salem Witch Museum, how do you spell that phrase? And I didn't think clearly about the injustice that had been done to women in Salem and how there are witches today and that that's a viable spiritual option. And so I asked the woman who answered the phone this question, and I asked it respectfully. She got very angry with me and put a curse on me. And the curse, has lasted ever since. I don't know what has not happened in my life because I was cursed by a witch, but I don't know how to spell nya-ha-ha either.
What did she say to you? Like, do you remember what the curse was?
No, she just, you know, she said
words.
I didn't understand witches and that I was being rude. And that was sort of the end of the conversation.
My God, I kind of hoped for a second that it was like a big scenario and you were going to be transported to a child's body. But no, that didn't happen.
No, that did not happen.
You know, one of the things you talk about in that keynote speech that I really loved, because it's another one of my favorite scenes in the movie, which is toward the end, you talk about that penultimate epic scene where the wizard turns to the Scarecrow and the Tin Man and the Lion. And he says, "You already had everything you needed." Tell me a little bit about why that scene is important to you.
Well, it goes with the line just before that, which is ignore the man behind the curtain. We would like to believe that the man behind the curtain is actually pulling most of the strings in our life, that human beings are storytelling machines. We look for explanations, and when we don't have an explanation, we assume it's the man behind the curtain who has somehow pulled a lever. And when we're not getting what we need, we assume it's because we don't have a diploma or we don't have a watch or we don't have a badge or a certification of our bravery. But, you know, the Treasure of Sierra Madre had a spoof done about it, about the monkeys, and by the monkeys, the TV show. And in that, they used the line, "Badges, we don't need no stinking badges." And in fact, that line is really important. Because in this year, in this century, badges are worth way less than they used to be. And one by one, we are seeing that our work describes who we are, not our certificate. And if we can merely do the work and show up, then we have a chance to make a difference. You know, you don't need a PhD in film studies to make a podcast about movies. You used to. You used to need a certificate to get into the Academy. Certificates are now easily printed on your local laser printer. And so the idea that we should hold ourselves back because the man behind the curtain hasn't given us the magic doesn't make any sense. It's a form of hiding. And where we can self-publish, where we can self-edit, where we can self-broadcast, where we can self-create, I think that's what we should do, not spend time looking for the certificate. Yes, we should get smart. Yes, we should practice our craft. But we don't need it to be accredited.
Yeah, as you said in that keynote, you already have what you need to go to the next level.
And if you don't, we know where you can go get it. But
exactly.
the place to go get it might not be a place that costs you $250,000 and takes 4 years.
You know, I never had seen The Tin Man and the Scarecrow and the Cowardly Lion in this way. Again, Roger Ebert, quoting him, because he blew my mind with a lot of the perceptions that he had. He said that they were projections of every child's secret fears. Are we real? Are we ugly and silly? Are we brave enough? In helping them, Dorothy was helping herself, just as an older child will overcome fears by acting brave before a younger one.
Wow.
I know.
Yes. That's brilliant. That's why he was Roger Ebert and we're not.
Exactly. He had everything he needed and he was able to show us what he saw that we just didn't see.
And it's funny because that's not from Frank Baum. That's a sort of an accident because there are plenty of other characters in the original books, which I've spent hours and hours reading. The books are all over the place. And the biggest difference in the books is Oz is a real place in the books. That the dream sequence was invented by plays and movies done before this movie, and they just stole
that. That's fascinating. I didn't know that.
But they didn't take it from the book.
Huh. Wow. Do you think that was additive? I haven't read the books, and you have, that they did that as a dream sequence?
I think it's insanely profound. It's most dream sequences are a hack that are used by a screenwriter who can't figure out a way to write themselves out of a problem.
Yeah, yeah.
But in this case, they understood that in 1939, you couldn't ground the audience in the story you wanted to tell if you just told a straight up filmed fantasy. You might be able to do it with animation like Snow White, but we needed a reason to identify with Dorothy. And in the original scripts for the movie, the Kansas thing was much, much longer and much, much more complicated. And when they got back, Dorothy was gonna be invited by Ray to come visit him in the city, and they were going to have a romantic setup for the sequel. I'm glad none of that occurred in real life. Right?
Oh
but so
God,
they were just hacking their way through this, but it ended up being exactly the right length. And the idea that those people in Kansas were the same people as in Oz is just profound. That it wasn't invented by anyone who worked on the movie, but what a leap. And it sort of makes me tingle that someone created that concept.
You're so right. It grounds us in a way that we wouldn't have been able to see if it had stuck to the original material.
Can I just share one other piece of trivia that we haven't
Please
talked
do.
About?
Please do. Yes, yes.
Okay. So the Munchkins were from Germany. They were part of a troupe called the Singer Midgets. And they were called Singer, not because they could sing, but because the guy in charge of them was named Singer. And the really profound thing that I just learned is after the movie was made, these German small people, little people, didn't go back to Germany because if they did, they would have died. And so the Wizard of Oz saved their lives.
Wow. Oh, my God. That is amazing. I didn't know that. There are so many layers and depths to this film, both in the making of and actually on screen, that are just fascinating to learn about.
Yeah, it's a microcosm for what was going on then, for the rise of TV, and for me, for who we are now. That when I think back to 1966 or 1967, watching that movie with my parents and my sisters, and about all the possibility and the doors that have been opened for people with privilege like me and people with less privilege. What do we do with it? Why do we go through the door or not go through the door? What does it mean to act as if, to see possibility where other people don't see it? And if I feel like I'm flagging in this journey, then it's worth listening to the soundtrack or watching it one more time. Because if Dorothy can do this thing she did, and I know it's not real life, it's Oz, well, then what's keeping us from doing it?
Yeah. I know you revisit this movie often, and you cite it in your work, and it's clearly always present in your mind. And I just wonder if you talk a little bit about how it's changed for you as you've gotten older since you first saw it as a kid.
Well, let me tell you what hasn't changed. I really expected, you know, I used to have a software company early days of the internet called Yoyodyne. And Yoyodyne was not named after the Thomas Pynchon novel, Crying of Lot 49. It was named after the company in the really cheesy movie, Buckaroo Banzai. And I found Buckaroo Banzai about a year ago and showed it to some people, sure that it would be unbelievable as I remembered it. And it's not even close.
Yeah, no kidding.
You can't watch even 3 minutes of it without getting up to stretch. And when I watch The Wizard of Oz, there are no edits I want to make. There's no performances I want anyone to redo. It was the triumph, which didn't happen very often, of the Hollywood studio system, where professionals showed up and just did their job, but they did it beautifully, and it truly is timeless. And I don't think that's because I grew up with it. I think every once in a while, a blind squirrel finds an acorn, and this is a really big acorn.
Yeah, you know, I have to say, this makes me want to watch the movie again after listening to you talk about it and seeing it in that way. Thank you for that. Is there anything else that I didn't ask you about it that you want to say?
You know, I think that the reason we watch movies isn't to pass the time, because even today, people go to the movies and check their email during the movie, so they could just stay home and check their email.
I hate those people, by the way.
Yeah, they kick them out of Alamo quite happily.
Yeah, exactly.
I think the reason we watch a movie now is so we can have something to talk about with other people, and more important, with ourselves. And if a movie can't deliver that to you, then it probably hasn't achieved its potential. And so for me, most people don't want to talk to me about The Wizard of Oz, but I want to talk to myself about it. So I do. And
I love that.
That this magical podcast you're creating is doing that over and over again for people, showing them movies that might help them have a better conversation about who they want to become and who they're contributing to and what matters.
And hopefully they'll feel less alone, right?
Exactly.
Thank you, Seth. I so appreciate this. And really, you've changed the way that I view this movie. So thank you.
Well, we're off to see the wonderful
movie. I love it. Well, thank you so much again. And I hope you have a great weekend and a good rest of the day.
You too. Bye-bye.
Okay. Bye.